would sum up my view of globalization and its contradictions is this. There are two great dangers in the world today as far as the discussion of the past, the end of the Cold War, and of globalization and its future are concerned. One, the most important one, particularly in the mid-Atlantic world, particularly in the columns of the newspapers and the speeches of politicians, is complacency. The belief that they have found a solution, that the end of the Cold War showed they had a solution, that all people have to do is to privatize, to marketize, and everything will be all right. But the other danger is pessimism. It's to say everything is impossible, the world is heading for disaster, we're heading for a new Third World War, we're heading for a clash of civilizations, and so forth. I think our position has to be, can be, somewhere between. We must challenge the complacency, but we must also avoid the pessimism. And here, for the 20 millionth time, but I make no apologies for it, we will fall back on to the famous remark of Antonio Gramsci's, that we have pessimism of the intellect, but optimism of the will. And I think faced with this global complacency on the one hand, and this pessimism of the right and of the left, we have to find an optimism of the will based on our analysis.
Hello, my name is Sean Macheza, and you're listening to History in Action, 50 Years of Activism and Ideas, a Counter-History by the Transnational Institute. Over the course of 5 episodes, we'll cover some of the major moments that have shaped the international left over the last 50 years. It's a story of ideas, movements, and personalities that have shaped the world today. It's a story of the rise of new forms of capitalism and authoritarianism. It's also the story of a global progressive think tank, the Transnational Institute, or TNI. And above all, it's a story of resistance and hope. You just heard Fred Halliday, Professor of International Relations at the London School of Economics until 2008, and one of TNI's first fellows. He was speaking at TNI's 25th anniversary in 1999, speaking about globalization in the aftermath of the Cold War. In this episode, we talk about the events that shaped the first decade of the 21st century, the disastrous war on terror, the rise of China, the convergence of social movements around the climate crisis, land, and essential public services.
The end of the Cold War was a result of what? Everybody claims it as being a result of their particular contribution. The Reaganites say it was the arms race. The analysis from within the Soviet Union is very much about the change in the movement in the party and the change at the top. But we have to remember the role of social movements and the role of ideas. There were always social movements in the Cold War. And this is of all the dimensions of the Cold War, not just the end of the Cold War, but the Cold War itself, the element which is forgotten. When we say social movements, we include the resistance movements in Europe, we include the Third World radical movements in Vietnam, in China, in South Africa, in Latin America, and I repeat again, the social movements within the developed countries themselves, of which the American Civil Rights Movement was the most dramatic and one of the first examples in the early 1960s, and whose echoes still continue to this day. So we should never let go of the argument that the end of the Cold War came about in part because of social movements, because of new ideas. The idea that there could be a reduction in nuclear weapons, there could even be an abolition of nuclear weapons, that nuclear weapons did not bring security, that nuclear energy itself was highly problematic. These were ideas which were promoted by alternative thinkers East and West. And don't forget that one of the first ideas that was articulated in Eastern Europe was the idea of the dangers of nuclear energy, both military and civilian, along with environmental issues, feminist issues, and other issues which came to the fore in the early and mid-1980s. And the lesson for the future is very clear, that social movements, ideas, even ideas produced by academics or intellectuals, may well have a very important impact.
As the 20th century dawned, hopes for a new era of peace and prosperity would not last long. Latin America's political landscape offered perhaps the brightest hope in what would become known as the Pink Tide. But across the world, big businesses responded to pressure from sensible regulation by grabbing resources and land in harder to regulate parts of the world. China continued its dizzying rise and would emerge as a major power, But our story begins with the events of September 11, 2001, and more specifically, how the response to that terrible day continues to hurt us all today.
My name's Arun Kundanani. I'm a writer and activist based in Philadelphia in the United States. And I write about radical political movements, anti-racism, the war on terror, neoliberalism, surveillance, things like that. And I've been involved in different movements over the years, really since the 1990s in Britain, where I was born, and the United States, where I live. So I worked in the 1990s with an organization in London called the Institute of Race Relations, which had a longer history with collaborating with the Transnational Institute since the 1970s. Got to know something about their work that way. But I really became involved much more closely, I think, in the 2010s when I started to work with TNI on really on how the war on terror was shrinking the space for social and political movements during that time.
The warnings were stark even as early as 2001. Rolling back civil liberties and deploying mass surveillance would be the war on terror's lasting legacy. In the years that have followed, technology has enabled terrifying levels of surveillance.
The technology part of it is very straightforward, right? Like the way that we have this, we live with this surveillance infrastructure through our cell phones, through all our digital lives, and all the data that's collected from that ultimately, which is available to intelligence agencies, to police forces, and so on. Now, that whole thing was legitimized as it emerged in the war on terror years. And by saying we need to be able to do this to stop terrorists. So the fact of that's the straightforward part of it. So I think here in the United States, the war on terror is really like the ghost haunting this general election that we're going to have in November this year in 2024. On the side of the Democrats, we're in the midst of an indirect war on terror that the United States is funding in Israel, right? Like the war on Gaza is also a kind of war on terror. And the pro-Palestinian movement has successfully given voice to a significant constituency in the United States who oppose that. And the failure of the Democratic Party leadership to recognize that and embrace that is what has weakened their chances of prevailing against Trump in the election. And the reason they're choosing not to do that is because they have still got the same mindset of the war on terror, right? That you support Zionism at all costs. That in the end you can resolve a conflict like what's happening in Gaza through just having more military force than your opponents, and never thinking that you need a political solution, which of course in the end is the only way that it gets resolved, right? So that war on terror thinking is still very much with us in that situation. And then on the Trump side, if you look at how did Trump first emerge in 2015, 2016 as a possible presidential candidate for the Republicans, his first move was the Muslim ban, right? That's his idea that you ban Muslims from coming into the United States because they might be terrorists. That kind of idea was what basically turned him from a celebrity businessman into someone who was going to be the Republican candidate. And so that was obviously, you know, that was only possible because of the war on terror. And if you look at who is his base politically in this country, a core constituency is veterans, right? Who were sent to fight these wars on terror in Iraq and Afghanistan and so on, who thought they were being patriotic and defending the United States after 9/11. But on the ground, their experience was, one, the United States lost those wars. They don't say that publicly, but of course they lost those wars, and the people who fought the wars know that. And they realized that the wars were based on lies and weren't really anything to do with protecting ordinary people in the United States, which is why they thought they were fighting. So they come back with that disillusionment, right? The Democratic Party isn't really explaining anything to them or giving them any kind of narrative to help them make sense of what went wrong. But the far right is saying to them, yeah, you were lied to by the liberal elites who sent you to fight these wars on terror and to protect global interests, that kind of idea. And now actually the real war is at home against the immigrants and against the Muslims and so on, right? And that was essentially the core message that Trump, you know, built his movement around, and that still might get him back into the White House in January. And so, again, it's the war on terror that you can't, as a country, you can't send lots of your own people to fight wars in other parts of the world, cause the deaths of over 1 million people in Iraq, and then just when that feels like a chapter that you want to move on from, just pretend it never happened, draw a line under it, and hope that everyone forgets, right? Like that, it doesn't work like that. These things come back in all kinds of ways that you can't control. And that's why it's a haunting, right? We're haunted by that. We've never fully come to terms with what it means. What does it mean that the United States is the kind of country that's able to carry out a war of aggression that kills 1 million people, right? We've never had that conversation in any serious way. We've never had a conversation about what does it mean to transition out of that kind of way of thinking into a society that organizes itself around caring, not killing, education, healthcare, and so on, right? That's the conversation that we ought to have had coming out of the war on terror and trying to reflect on some of its lessons. Obviously, the Republicans go in a different direction. The Democrats have never wanted to have that conversation.
As neoliberalism entwined people and politics around the world, it enabled businesses to tighten their grip globally, ripping land and resources from the global south and subverting environmental action in the global north. Fortunately, international movements were also consolidating.
This was a global trend within the movement. The climate crisis was becoming more and more evident. So at the same time as Enlazando Alternativas was happening and the tribunal was happening, the global movements were coming more and more engaged in the analysis, resistances, and proposals to solve the climate crisis. So I remember in 2009 in Copenhagen, there was at the time it was the biggest mobilization, then there were other bigger. But at that time it was like bringing together Enlazando Alternativas organizations, HSA organizations, and global organizations on the climate justice movement, the concept of climate justice. Even though it existed before, it was stronger and more adopted within the organizations. And after Copenhagen, it was the Mother Earth Summit, the Rights of Mother Earth Summit in Bolivia in 2010. So I think it's nice to see together those different trends coming. No? We have the Enlazando Alternativas one and all this debate on climate change and how it became more and more evident that the need was system change, and the actors behind the crisis were the same actors that we were judging in the tribunal. We're the corporations. So it was not delinked. It was actually more and more clear that we were talking about the neoliberal model, the capitalist system, and the role of corporations. So when I came to TNI in 2011, the idea was to deepen into that perspective, the resistance to climate crisis with the systemic analysis and how to, put on the responsibility of the transnational corporations in the climate crisis. And at the same time, TNI was already doing, time ago, the work on land grabbing. So if we were looking from the perspective of climate justice, the use of land needed the grounding, the use of resources needed the grounding and the justice lenses to think on alternatives and real solutions. So it was like evident that both areas of work needed to come together. In terms of history of the agrarian justice and land, the right to land work, what I can say about that is that it was a very interesting work of bringing together, again, the bridge, no? The bridge between scholars, activists, and activists from the movements, no? We have activists in the academia and activists in the movement and how to bring them together. That's something that, that the project at the time, the Agrarian Justice Project at the time, made clearly and radically. And the capacity of putting on concepts about justice, about the use, management and control of land, was a way of giving tools to the movements to reclaim their rights. And that reach was what T and I was doing, bringing those concepts and making them tools for the resistances. And that, of course, was key with movements like Via Campesina, because that's the global movement of peasant people. So they were key in that exchange. But without the trust that TNI has built, had built with the movements, that bridge was not possible. So I think that is key, how TNI can build bridges, because it has built the trust over the years. Otherwise, no one will come to an invitation from an institute in the Netherlands. It's because the institute represents radical ideas that serve movements. So movements trust in TNI and can come. And then with the land work, that bridge was very clear in linking with academics. And as I was saying, providing with concept tools, ideas into the movement, into the peasants' movements. And also because of the existing alliances, as the ones that I was describing with Enlazando Alternativas and all of that, it was not only with the peasant movements. We could bring together other movements into that discussion. So that's when I came to that point, because, yeah, it was easy to talk about real solutions to the climate crisis, environmental justice and agrarian justice together. And then also, like, that bridge did have different entry points with more movement. I will say that was more clearly happened in 2015 with the COP in Paris. But of course, it's a process, no? And I would say, and that moment, the process had a turning point to bring together the agrarian justice, environmental justice perspectives, the academics with different movements. And he and I was at a privileged position to do that because of what I was saying, the trust that has been built for over the years, the perspective, people knew that he and I had a radical and critical perspective and a lot of work on transnational corporations and on analyzing the neoliberal model on how it is critical for peoples everywhere, not only in the South. So the possibility from the movements in the South to relay to affected people in Europe really made a difference to build that trust.
Bali 2008. Again, at the forefront of Bali 2008 was Via Campesina. At that time, Via Campesina was being headquartered in Indonesia. Uh-huh. So there was like this convergence of shift from WTO and then transitioning into climate justice struggles. And in all those waves, agrarian struggles and Via Campesina very much central. And then food sovereignty as a political movement and as a political project started to really gain momentum around the time. So that's one push in which T and I started to look closer into the importance of that. And then 2008 also was that year when global land grabbing just exploded globally as an issue. So from then onwards, so agrarian and land become a key issue globally. And TNI, my work and Jenny's work on land became foundational in that sense. And so we started to produce primer on land grabs and ocean grabs and water grabs that became some of the most downloaded papers in TNI around that time. So it became very important kind of framing and reshaping. It contributed to sharpening land campaigns globally by agrarian movements and other. So that, and then suddenly it converged with the opening of Myanmar politics, in which 2010-11, there was this relative opening of a semi-military, semi-civilian transition. And TNI was already there. And then one of the biggest issues that when during that opening is land. So we were mobilized to go there. And so the rest is history. It became an intertwining of the Myanmar program, in which land is so central, and then globally with the land grabs and everything. So around that time, from 2008 to, I would say, a decade after, became quite central. The work of TNI became quite influential and important in global struggles.
Many Latin American states turned to the left in the early years of the 21st century in what's often referred to as the pink tide. But behind this tide was a way of approaching movement politics that much of the rest of the world would soon come to learn from. Brid Brennan is a popular educator and political activist working with TNI since the early 1990s. She focuses on international governance, the role of transnational corporations, and efforts to hold them to account.
Of course, there have existed strong relations of movements in Europe with Latin America all through the years of the dictatorship, and also in the new situation here in Latin America, in creating a new politics, a politics for alternatives to a neoliberal model. In Europe right now, we need actually a convergence of movements, efforts on a continental level, because until now we do not have a movement dealing with the current crisis at a continental level in Europe. And we take a lot of inspiration from, for example, the continental-wide struggles that we're hearing in Latin America against dictatorship, but also the continental-wide struggle against the imposition of the free trade agreements of the Americas, and the victories that the people achieved in rejecting that. It has demonstrated very well that a continental-wide movement can be built, and I think from Europe we look to that inspiration in Latin America.
I don't want to sound wrong when we say that Latin American movements influence the whole world. Being Latin American, I want to keep humble in that sense. And I think, in the idea of international solidarity, we all take influence and take inspiration from other regions, and we learn from other regions' mistakes. And maybe that's a way of seeing what has happened with Latin America. No, I wouldn't say the big influence. Yeah, it's part of this international solidarity law and learning. And yeah, of course, if we look at the history of the military coups in almost all of the region, and then the different struggles for liberation in different countries and regions. And I'm talking, around the 80s, 70s. My country is an exception. All of that was an inspiration, I think, for the world. And all of that brought a lot of solidarity from many people who migrated in exile to Europe, and from also people from Europe and other parts in the world who came to the region to support the struggle. So I think in that sense, Latin America has had the privilege of being visible in the struggles. And in the most recent history, the victory against the free trade of the agreement of the Americas, was a big achievement, because it was defeating the U.S. in a political and economic project in a moment of absolute hegemony. So that's maybe why it became so inspirational. for us in the region and for the world. Maybe, yeah, it was, I think, in the recent history that was meaningful to defeat the U.S. in that political and economic project. Of course, there are other moments when movements have done that, and peoples and state to bring your question together. That defeat was possible because of the mobilization that brought together millions of people against the proposal, the model, but also because of that mobilization led to changes in governments in some key countries. So the so-called pink tide was key to make that defeat happening. And I couldn't see separately the movements and the governments at that period. Even though the policies and the reality afterwards had a lot of complications, the fact that those governments were in place and stopped the FTAA was also a result of mobilization, resistances, and organized movements. So I think that's what was so inspirational. Then history has given a lot of turns up, down, around, and we are facing we had faced the pushback from the right wing, the mistakes from the governments as well, the internal disputes that show that it's not only a matter of government, but it's also a matter of power. And then the fact that movements have been able to keep together the resistances, the ideas, and the proposals in light of all of what's happening, I think that's what I find key. So, yeah, maybe it is the political formation understood as a process, as a long-term process. But I think it's also the tradition of alliances. And building alliances is very difficult. Building trust among movements is very difficult. But to be able to keep those alliances, despite the differences, in light of a bigger goal, is something that has been key to keep together the movements and to try to keep the strength, even in dark moments when the right wing has kicked back really hard. And right now, I would say we are at a moment when we are in permanent dispute. There are some governments that give a light of hope, but those governments themselves are under a lot of pressure. And in the previous period, of course, there was a lot of pressure. There was the right wing trying to push them back, but not as hard as it is happening. And I think that is a trend not only in Latin America, but worldwide, how the conservative values are so in there that it's really hard for organizations and movements to confront the pushback. The processes of mobilization and political formation are something that help to keep us together. But we are at a moment where more is needed, when we need to be more creative to be able to confront those in the conservative values that are threatening democracy, that are threatening justice and life in itself, not only in Latin America. Again, it's worldwide.
It was difficult to read a newspaper in the early 2000s without discovering an article about the rise of China. Though the phrase is still used today, it's hard to deny that by the opening of the Beijing Olympics in 2008, China had already risen. Still, too often, China is cast as an aggressive challenger to Western hegemony, bent on world domination. More likely, there's more than one simple answer to the question of the significance of China's rise. There is an apocryphal but entertaining story about Henry Kissinger's discussion of the consequences of the French Revolution with Zhou Enlai. Zhou is alleged to have concluded, "It's just too early to tell."
quite a number of us were looking at China, and we were not enamored of what was happening in China. It was very clear that China was becoming a capitalist country. And at the same time, I think we were not about to condemn China. Because at the same time, we knew that the Chinese were engaged in a very complex experiment. But at the same time, who are you to condemn a process that basically reduces the poor part of the population to 2% of the population? Okay, and that's not the Chinese government figure, that's the World Bank. When the United States, as of this point, the estimate is that 11% of the population lives below the poverty line. So China was, we looked at the Chinese experiment. We did not, I don't think we were about to condemn it. We may disagree with it. But at the same time, I think we were open to what was happening. And what was happening fully was to emerge mainly in the period of 2010 to 2020, when you had this rapid growth at 10% a year that created a new superpower that balanced the United States and in fact became the center of global capitalist accumulation. But knowing at the same time that many countries in the developing world were assisted by the emergence of China, not only in terms of aid, not only in terms of investment, but also in terms of offering a model for rapid growth and poverty reduction, that many aspects of which we disagreed with, but at the same time, how it was something that you may disagree with, but at the same time, you had to appreciate the fact that China's rise had changed the world.
Also changing the world was the intensifying climate crisis. The ponderous and dithering response from global governments has already cost lives and livelihoods around the world. And in response, global civil society turned up the pressure, underpinning all other demands, climate justice.
I would go back to 2007 when the COP 13 was held in Bali. And again, I discussed with Asian partners, okay, this is the first time that it will be held in Indonesia. And I think also because TNI also has a big interest on Indonesian democracy. And we also, at that time, we were discussing there, not just us, but also what now evolved as the global climate justice movement, that there is a need to redefine the work of climate. And for many people in the global south, you have also the similar experience that the fight for climate is also, or emanates, stems, arises from questioning the global economic model, that this climate frying development model that serves the global north countries and created many unjust forms of relations between the north and south. So when the climate justice movement started questioning what should be the, we need to enlarge, we need to make the parameters of climate work broader, because first and foremost, it's not just about the environment. The climate crisis is just a symptom of the deep-seated problem, crisis in the economy and the global north and south relations. So at that time, that kind of idea, that concept is quite new. And the climate justice now actually broke away from the traditional environment work by building a new movement where you have peasants and farmers that wanted to discuss about food sovereignty. You have these people that wanted to talk about fighting for their territorial sovereignty and the right to determine what is good for their economy. You also have feminists were saying that climate justice and gender justice. I think the big part of that is how do you also stop the financial flow from the south to the north, which is very uneven. So then that means you also have to talk about the debt, foreign debt of many developing countries, and the idea or introducing the concept of climate debt. So those are at that time, those were ideas that are new, even not just from the movements, but also in the academy. The concept of saying or the concept of climate debt as it's actually the North that are indebted to the South. And then at the same time, in pursuing solutions to the climate crisis, then it is creating more and more injustices and it's creating more spaces for oppression and also dispossession of people, communities, sectors in the global South. So those were the time, and I remember in the COP in the COP17 in Durban. So T and I organized an event as well on how to do. So from the 2007, at that time in 2011, the idea or even the phrase system change, not climate change, was already being said. You already see it in many banners, but what does it actually mean? So many people at that time, that event in Durban was one of those events where the discussions on the role of institutions, processes, actors like trade, finance, investments. It's not the first time it was discussed, but the quality of the discussion is something very different. And I remember those discussions also when we were also looking at the role of the new powers, the role of BRICS, the role of China especially, and the interesting way that or the fact trade and climate are actually go hand in hand. That many of the so that role of the FTA, the free trade agreements that wherein you have the investor state dispute settlement, which all those provisions and investment are obstructing climate solutions. So it was 2011 and we were already discussing that. And I think many of the current work, the TNI, the other global movements, you can see the timeline, but at the same time, how ideas and not just campaign, but how new concepts evolve, both from practice, both from long traditions of struggles, and how those struggle also reach a different phase, and at the same time, how they also in those changing phases, how the context also evolved and how new challenges come in. Because now when we talk about climate, we also have to consider that what about the role of peace as well? And that was my last collaboration with TNI this year when we organized the in Marseille, the event on the common space for and the first pillar of that or the first theme on that is looking at the question of how do we achieve peace and climate at the same time, because both are existential issues and both could change the world and the solutions. So I think this kind of initiatives as well, that we wanted to look at what would be the various angles on a topic that is also something I really value working with TNI, because it's beyond campaign most of the time. It's beyond just an analysis, but also looking deeply at what are the history of concepts. Because I think in many ways that is the a bit of a weakness in social movements that because we're so busy struggling and fighting at the moment, we need the time to pause as well and see, wait a minute, you know what? How did this came about? What are the history of those concepts? What were the debate at certain particular period? And we have all, it's also nice to look back during those time when there were debates, some ideas win, some ideas lose, or were not taken up more popularly. And in many instances, not because they are bad ideas, but maybe because the time has not come yet. Also, it needed a particular, there will be a particular context wherein those ideas would need to be picked up again. And that's how social movements strengthen itself by looking back and looking forward as well. So it is important to learn from past debates and at the same time look at the, okay, how is it different or how is it similar to the current debates?
The climate crisis is a systemic crisis that poses formidable challenges. Addressing these challenges demands ingenuity and collective action. At TNI, we have found great hope in the people, movements, and collectives working to bring essential services, such as water or energy, under public democratic control, which in turn can enable us all to be bolder about a just transition. Many of these ideas coalesced around perhaps the most essential need, water. From 1999 to 2000, protests fought against privatization of water in Cochabamba, Bolivia, reinvigorating the global pushback against privatization and towards essential services centered on people, not profit. Satoko Kishimoto is the first female mayor of Suginami, Tokyo. For over a decade, she led TNI's work on reclaiming public services. Here she is speaking at the Asia-Europe People's Forum in 2018.
How do you run the public services in Asia and the other parts of the world? Which is better, public system, private system? I think the through research, through experiences, not only Asia, anywhere in the world, the evidence the private management doesn't really serve public interest is getting clear and clear. So the social impact in Asian countries like Philippines is even greater than the countries in Europe. Why? For instance, the water services, if there is not universal access is not achieved yet, the pipe has to be put. The infrastructure has to be made. So in many countries in the north, all those work is done by the government. It's a huge, massive national project, which bring a lot of benefit to people and the economy. That's the particularly that we have to be very cautious. The water and transport, the energy, especially universal access is the goal. We cannot over expect private sector. That's the evidence and experience shows. I just came from Jakarta, where the people, workers are really fighting hard the water privatization, which was introduced 20 years ago. The water services in Jakarta has proven not only the poor services and very expensive, but also we are facing the huge problem of the power, the contract between the companies and the states. It's very unfair. It's designed by design, the creating more the public debt. Then eventually, what is difficult is to stop such a very bad contract for the local authority and people. Once you enter the privatization, it is very difficult to stop or terminate. This is a lesson everywhere, not only Jakarta, but the world. So we, as citizen workers, be very cautious in what kind of services, how to finance infrastructure, which everybody needs, to make a logical choice based on a lot of lessons we shared.
I think the public alternatives work accompanied the beginnings of the entrenchment of neoliberal principles, because I think neoliberalism, as I always understood it, was deregulation, privatization, and financialization. Those were the three pillars of neoliberalism. So privatization was a critical one. And what you saw with the WTO rules, for example, was all kinds of obstacles to keeping things public, firstly, so a push for privatization, And also the role of the international financial institutions, I think, are also, but anyway, there was through neoliberalism, through the WTO trade agreements and the international financial institutions, there was pressure to privatize everything, outsource and privatize. That was very much the model of neoliberalism. So T and I began work, I think, with reinventing the commons. I think that was the first time we started looking at privatization in a serious way. And then in the early 2000s, we began work on two fronts, on water and energy, and also on the General Agreement on Trade and Services, GATS. So we were also one of the first to really look at that, about what was being pushed for in terms of turning all services into private services. But in particular, we looked at water and energy in terms of building movements there. So Satoka Kishimoto joined us, I think, around 2002. And Daniel Chavez also arrived at TNI around the same time. And Satoka basically built this really remarkable international water anti-privatization movement, together with Maud Barlow. And there was a whole global network. But trying to always look at what do we want. I think that was really good about Satoka always, was less the work on the privatization that was taking place and more on how do we stop it and what would we want if we could do that. So that was Reclaim Public Water, that little booklet that was updated and translated into 15 languages, but it was very much representative. It wasn't a book. It was more a reflection of the views of activists from around the world. And every time the book was published in another language, so the cases and the voices and the testimonies from the region of those that language was added to the book, and it became this kind of living document. But it also showed the growth of that water movement. And then on the energy front, we started with the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network, which was also linked to there was this Durban meeting around the Kyoto Protocol at that time, but focusing on energy poverty and how to address that in a renewable way. And this was this TNI IPS project in the mid-90s. We then took on a very international energy project, which was brought to us actually by someone who had worked for both ends, and they had run out of capacity to manage the project, and they brought it to TNI, which was looking at energy systems in different parts of the world and debates about how to keep energy public, but also how to shift from nuclear to non-nuclear. At that time, nuclear was still very controversial then, and from fossil fuels to renewable energies. We then also took on the Carbon Trade Watch project, which was it was a couple of people who had been associated with Corporate Europe Observatory who wanted to start work on criticizing carbon trading. And TNI was really pioneering with that work. And we were heavily criticized originally for even taking that was irrelevant and unimportant, and we were undermining possible new solutions. But this basically exposing the nonsense of carbon trading, that it's basically like squeezing a balloon. You squeeze it there and it pops up somewhere else, but it doesn't actually change anything. It's the same pollution being moved around the world and companies still profiting literally from hot air. So there was the carbon trading project, and then out of that came this notion of false solutions. And And then ultimately, we started to work on agri-fuels as one of those false solutions, and we've worked on many others. And today we talk in broader terms about just transitions, or what a just green industrial policy could look like, or how do you shape a just green economy. So that's been the kind of trajectory of the energy work. I think also today we still very much focused on public power, so showing the failures of that privatized energy can never solve the energy questions. It will only generate energy that can make a profit, which means a whole lot of people will be excluded, the less profitable renewables become, the less profit can be made from them, and therefore the private market is never going to drive any transition. So those are trajectories of that work. So within the frame of neoliberalism, but also particularly with the energy work within the frame of climate. And then we merged those two projects, I think, somewhere around 2015 or so, maybe 2011. But they came together as what we tried to reshape it as public alternatives generally to give us the space to also look at transport, health, other questions of public services, and also to fight back against the EU directives that were intending to go the privatized direction, the kind of corporate rules that were mitigating against a public approach as opposed to a private approach. I think also what we saw there with the public, the emphasis on the public, is that also these are public assets, so they're commons. They should be owned by no one and regulated by the state for the common benefit. And then even if you're not a socialist, you should see these as services that are necessary for the reproduction of our societies. So whether it's taking care of children or providing basic energy or life-giving water or whatever, these are not things that should ever be controlled by private companies in the interest of those who can pay for those services. And we started mapping where it was clear that the private sector withdraws from public things that should be public services, that they withdraw from it when it becomes unprofitable, and exposing that and looking, mapping where what we called re-municipalization, but that there was in fact a momentum, a trend to take public services back into public control and ownership. And that public control and ownership is also important because it's not just that it's state-owned, but that it's democratized, that states are working with communities, with the people for whom those services are intended, to improve them, to shape them, to have a say, the form that they take.
But in the latter half of the 2000s, storm clouds were gathering. At the time, some predicted that the fallout of the gathering disaster would lead to the further hollowing out of essential services in the global north and the resurgence of authoritarianism around the world. They were correct. Howard Wachtel is Professor Emeritus of Economics at the American University in Washington, D.C. He was the first coordinator of TNI's Global Economy Program. Speaking to Eric Hyman in 1999, Howard made a prediction that would prove startlingly accurate.
My prediction is the next region of the world to see the kind of financial disturbance at large scale. It's Europe. That's the next place that this earthquake is going to hit. And these are monumental issues.
Thanks.
The consequences are austerity, inflation, or the negative consequences. And the elites walk away close.
In the next episode, we discuss the fallout from the financial crisis, shrinking space for civil society around the world, the rise of authoritarianism, and the massively effective mobilizations against corporate power and trade abuse. You've been listening to History in Action, 50 Years of Activism and Ideas, a five-part mini-series by the Transnational Institute on its 50th anniversary. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. You can discover more about the Transnational Institute at tni.org. Please consider supporting our vital ongoing work at tni.org/donate. Interviews for this podcast were conducted by Sean Macheza, Daria Gorshenina, and Dennis Burke, with archival interviews by Eric Hymans, Fiona Dove, Geoff Arborn, and Breed Brennan. The series is edited and produced by the Transnational Institute. Thanks to Eden Raskin, Susan Buck-Morse, Anthony Burnett, Fiona Dove, Eric Hymans, and the International Institute for Social History.